maybe you've noticed the stairs, the groceries, everything that's not as easy as they used to be. And you're starting to wonder, what would it look like to get a little help? At Care.com, asking for support doesn't mean giving up independence. The right kind of help lets you stay in charge. Whether you know what kind of care you need or you're just starting to look, Care.com is here to help. You can find background-checked in-home caregivers who fit your budget, or explore senior living communities at your own pace. Read reviews, request tours, compare options. And if it all feels overwhelming, our senior care advisors, all master's-level social workers, can help you create a plan. For a limited time, use the code LISTEN20 for 20% off your initial Care.com subscription. That's LISTEN20, all one word, good for 20% off. Start your senior care journey with confidence.
You know that goal you set at the start of the year? You can still do it, whether you're committed to a through hike with friends, lifting heavier, or simply walking more. It's not too late to stick with it and make your future self proud, especially with the all-in-one nutrition shake from Ka'Chava. Because quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Ka'Chava's all-in-one nutrition shake, and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. So instead of adding to your backstock of supplements that overpromise and underdeliver, simplify your progress with just 2 scoops of the highest quality ingredients. Stick with your wellness goals. Go to Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS. K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code NEWS.
Our democracy is hanging by a thread, but we know it's not about just winning and losing each battle. It's about persistence and building resilience.
That's why we're launching the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
If you're looking for ways to get engaged or just for ways to stay sane, we want to help you navigate what comes next.
It's an exciting collaboration with political dynamo Jess Craven, author of the Chop Wood, Carry Water newsletter.
And grassroots activist Steve Pearson, host of the How We Win podcast.
Every week on the Practivist Pod, we're going to have important conversations with changemakers, give you practical ways to make an impact, have some fun, and inspire hope.
This is more than a podcast. It's a place for our community to grow our practice of advocacy for justice, equity, and progress.
Action is the best antidote for anxiety. So subscribe to the Practivist Pod today.
It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And this is another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. And we've got a real special show for our listeners today with two prominent writers about what's going on inside Iran. A big flashpoint right now, a lot of uncertainty and a lot of apprehension. Our guests are Jason Rezaian of The Washington Post, who's had his own unique experience with the Iranian regime, having been imprisoned by it for over a year. And Houman Maj, an Iranian-American writer and contributor to NBC News. Jason and Houman, welcome to Spy Talk. Jason, I want to start with you. You had a very powerful column in the Post yesterday. The headline, "I've waited for this electrifying moment in Iran for 10 years. Tell us why you feel that way. And also, there's been quite a bit of head spinning news since you wrote that. And I don't know where that leaves you at the moment.
Oh, I appreciate it, Michael. Without going into a lot of detail, as everyone knows, we don't always write our own headlines. And I hope people actually read the column because it's tempered with a little bit of not just skepticism, but anxiety, right? I do think that the resilience and bravery of Iranians is something to be applauded, and I do think that they will achieve the destiny that many of them have long hoped for at some point. But there are also a lot of different ways that not only the United States but other allies could get in the way of progress in Iran. And I think we've witnessed that time and again. Just in the last hour or so, for the first time in over a week, we've been able to communicate with relatives in Iran. But that was only because someone who was a friend of a friend of a friend was able to connect to Starlink and hold up a telephone to call a landline of a relative who, you know, after much waiting, actually picked up the phone and said, we're okay, all things considered. But, you know, it's a very trying situation. And the reality is, I think the people of Iran have not enjoyed a lot of good friends over the years, certainly not in their own government, not in the U.S. government, clearly not in the Israeli government, and not too many other quarters as well.
So less than 48 hours ago, the president of the United States, Donald Trump, was threatening to attack Iran if it continued to execute demonstrators. And the estimates now are they are over 2,500. Trump then says late yesterday, he's been informed that the executions have stopped and that the planned execution of one of the protesters had been put off. And then Senator Lindsey Graham, right after that, says, no, they haven't stopped at all. And the Iranian regime is continuing its crackdown. Tell us what, starting with you, whom I'm bringing you in, tell us what you are hearing. Who's right now, Donald Trump or Lindsey Graham, or do we just not know? What are your expectations for over the next few days of what's going to happen?
Well, to the best of our knowledge, Donald Trump is correct and not Lindsey Graham. Well, he's half correct. Executions did not start. Crackdown depends on what you mean by crackdown. Very few people are going out on the street. And anybody who does venture out on the street, as far as I know, after dark, which is basically 4:35 o'clock, is sort of encouraged by the heavy, heavy security presence on the streets to go back home. So there are, on every corner of every major intersection, cops, riot police, motorcycle police, things that Jason and I have both seen inside Iran after the 2009 crackdown on the Green Movement. Similar to that, perhaps even more intense than it was then. So that is the crackdown. Yes, the crackdown exists. There's no internet, as Jason pointed out. That exists. No phone connection to the outside world. That exists. So that's the crackdown. And if that's what Lindsey Graham means, yes. Executions, no, he's wrong about that. Donald Trump is correct. I think I just literally 5 minutes ago saw that Donald Trump is taking credit for saving 800 people, which is exactly what he wants to do, is to say that I stopped the executions. I stopped the crackdown and I stopped 800 people from dying. Where he got that number from, I have no idea.
Can I just ask a question? When you said where he got that number from, I have no idea. I'm curious where we're getting any of our information from. Communications are broken down. There's a geopolitical sort of shuffle going on in terms of Iran. It's sort of being a lot of a gray zone in many ways. How do you think people who are getting any information, what is it?
The government itself has admitted to a little over 2,000 deaths throughout the country. That's the Iranian government. Now, we don't generally like to believe everything the government says, either them or Hamas in Gaza. So you can take that with a grain of salt. Estimates from human rights organizations, videos that people have seen of morgues, of hospitals, estimates go from that 2,500 number, which is sort of the number that I think Donald Trump has mentioned. I believe I could be wrong. Maybe I know he started out at like something like 500, but I think he may have said 2,500 as well, as high as 12,000. A few people have said as high as 20,000. But the numbers are, that's what you're saying is correct. As Jason pointed out, there are videos coming out through Starlink. There are witnesses. Right now, there are flights available. One of my cousin's kids just left Iran and landed in London. And so these are the eyewitnesses that we know, and some of them are bringing videos out with them. They're obviously allowing people to take their phones with them that have these videos on them. So based on all these estimates, it's not very clear what those numbers are. And again, I'll let Jason jump in here too to see if he has any specific people that have contacted him.
No, I think anytime you're dealing with a situation like this, it is a lot of speculation. And I think that's helpful for the authorities in the country where, potential atrocity is taking place to say, well, how do you know, right? You're not here and we've shut down communication. I think it's going to be a very long time before we know the extent of this. And I'm not going to say that the number is not relevant, because certainly, every assassinated, executed, murdered person is beyond relevant. But I think the idea is that we talked about the 2009 protests a bit. At that time, protests were mostly peaceful. The state did unleash violence, and 100 something protesters were killed in those protests back then. We saw more protesters killed in protests in 2019. And then, of course, during the Woman Life Freedom Movement in 2022, many more protesters. And it sounds as though, even by their official count, they're acknowledging a higher number than in any of those. But I think the willingness to unleash that kind of force onto people shows that they don't have other methods of responding to the society. The demands that people have over a whole swath of issues, whether it's the decline in purchasing power, the repressive nature of life in the country, environmental degradation, all of these things, they don't have credible responses to them. They've shown themselves incapable in recent years to respond to very natural demands from people. And I think that's in large part why we've kind of come to this head.
Of the two factors you mentioned, Jason, the economic distress for the Iranian people and the inability to get basic goods at reasonable prices on the one hand, and then also the repressive nature of the regime. How do you judge among them? Which is the driving factor for these protests? And Hooman, I'd like you to weigh in as well.
Look, I mean, I think it's the culmination of many factors, right? In a place where civil society has not been allowed to operate freely ever, but has been more and more and more restricted over time, and at the same time everybody has one of these and is able to clearly, most of the time except during this crackdown, see all of the ways that they're missing out on modern life, it's very frustrating for people. And it's an incredibly educated population, a connected population, as Houman just said. Flights are still coming and going. You know, everybody has relatives that live in the U.S. or in Europe. The brain drain is a real phenomenon. Anybody who can in recent years has left. And so I think it's not one factor. It's the combination of things and a restless society who doesn't see any hope for a brighter future. And, you know, I applaud that bravery. I would like to see more forethought into what they would like to see come next and hear about that and see if that's feasible. And one last thing that I want to say is that, you know, this idea of freedom and democracy is very different for people who've never experienced it before, right? And I think the strength of Iranian spending power in the early 2000s up until about 2011, when U.S. sanctions really started to kick in, was almost enough. You know, people could travel fairly freely. They could take trips to Thailand or Turkey or Dubai and, you know, kind of turn down the pressure a little bit. None of that stuff is available to people anymore. There are no options of pressure release inside the country, and people can't afford to go outside the country. And so, you know, it's a tinderbox.
Houman?
Absolutely. I mean, Jason's right. I mean, people are fed up, really. They're at their wits' end. That's the best way to describe it. I mean, everyone from, and they, you know, we talk about the bazaar merchants, this latest round of protests at the end of December started in the bazaar because people could no longer afford to sell goods. Because if you sold your goods today, tomorrow it would be 20% more expensive. How are you going to restock? Especially people who deal with imports, such as mobile phones. It actually started in the mobile phone sellers protest, and which really kind of sparked this thing among the people who said, wait a sec, I can't afford meat anymore. I can't even afford to take a taxi anymore. I need three jobs just to make a living. And as Jason pointed out, a sort of dead-end society where there's just no hope whatsoever. The sanctions that Donald Trump has put on Iran is part of the equation. Of course, sanctions mean things, the real is that the Iranian currency is in free fall, almost at Zimbabwe levels. And I'm talking about Zimbabwe back in the 70s and 80s, not now. And there's nobody can really see what the end game is. The president Pezeshkian has come out and said it before even these protests. My hands are tied. There's nothing I can do. If anybody has a good idea, please tell me. I mean, if you're an Iranian citizen, what do you say when your president says, I have no idea what to do? So they came up. They did actually after the protests, initially peaceful protests started. People were like, we need real change, which is why not the first time, but in large numbers, you saw people saying, wait a sec, this system doesn't work anymore. So that's where you hear, you know, regime change ideas and where people start talking about Pahlavi because he's the, you know, most visible of the exiled opposition leaders. Because people really don't see a solution because they don't believe that Supreme Leader will allow anyone to make a deal with Donald Trump, with the U.S. under Donald Trump. And if they don't make a deal with the U.S. under Donald Trump, then it's either war is coming or the economy is going to get worse. So what is your solution then as a person? You go out and say, please do something. And that something is either change the regime or have the regime change itself. And neither of those are happening right now. And so I think this tinderbox that Jason says, it's there. They've clearly put down this round of this crisis is sort of over in terms of the streets, but the crisis is certainly not by no means over in terms of the people's dissatisfaction, unhappiness, misery in many ways. And we have to see, the predictions are very hard, but certainly Donald Trump appears to have been satisfied initially last night anyway with Iran and is sort of willing to not interfere at this point, which I'm sure disappoints a lot of Iranians who want regime change.
You know, I think one thing that we should point out is that the velocity and spread of protests in Iran has been quickening and growing in the last decade or so, you know, especially since these 2017 protests. And then you had the Woman Life Freedom protests in 2022. The number of cities, towns, villages where that saw protests has never been as much as they are. And there's also, you know, at certain points, protests would happen in, you know, in Balochistan or in Kurdistan, right? It's more regionalized. At this point, there's no ethnic, religious, linguistic, socioeconomic divides. Everybody's disaffected, dissatisfied. And Houman's right. I mean, you know, Donald Trump wants to say, you know, I helped put these down. But, you know, it's only a matter of days, weeks, or months before people come out again. And, you know, this system still doesn't have an answer for any of these demands. And they're not going to be able to come up with one. As he said, when the president of the country says, I don't know, you got ideas. I mean, I think that there's a lot of people with a lot of ideas, and most of them include get the hell out of here and let somebody else do it.
So I just want to contextualize this in terms of the United States and just get your guys' take on a couple of things. One is the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, and Trump pulling out of it, and how that, does that have any impact on this, or is it just a totally separate thing? Because you sort of, you know, in terms of the economic fallout, et cetera, et cetera. That's the first thing. And the second thing, in terms of past, but recent, more recent than the far past, U.S. policy is, you know, Trump has been sort of both sides of it here. Well, we might attack, we might not attack. Oh, now we're satisfied, now we're dissatisfied. One of the things that happened in the Soleimani attack was that the Trump administration writ large made the determination that an attack on killing Soleimani would not get any kind of backlash right away from Iran, right? Remember, the answer was, we'll take our time to respond the way we want. And they turned out to be right about that, right? And I wonder how much of that kind of attitude on the United States part might still be in play here, or... And I'm just curious about how both those factors from our recent past might play into this, or are just totally off the table now.
Yeah, I mean, Trump getting out of the JCPOA was sort of a bit of a shock to the system in Iran. The JCPOA was quite popular because it opened up the economy. Sanctions were slowly being lifted. It wasn't universally welcomed by everyone, but generally speaking, it was popular, certainly among the merchant class. And Iran really didn't have an answer for the JCPOA withdrawal. And so Iran didn't really have an answer for what to do once the sanctions were reimposed on Iran. It was 2018 when Donald Trump withdrew, and for 2 years Iran tried to get the Europeans to stick to the sanctions, and then Iran started, probably in hindsight, mistakenly ramping up its nuclear program. And then Joe Biden got elected, and Joe Biden decided he was going to go back to the JCPOA, and then of course Iran didn't react very well to Joe Biden going back to the JCPOA. So there were a lot of missed opportunities to try to get the nuclear deal back on track, and it didn't happen either with Joe Biden or with Donald Trump in his second term, where he also said he wanted to make a new deal that was better than it. So to say that it had no effect on U.S.-Iran relations or no effect on Iran's economy would be wrong. But there's also a huge number of reasons why the Iranian government mismanaged its own economy, why the structure of the economy is such that it can't take care of its people unless it has some radical changes economically. So it's a combination of the two that have caused the economic misery in Iran, the combination of the sanctions, which clearly have hurt the economy and hurt ordinary people, and the mismanagement of the economy. In terms of Soleimani, and yes, Donald Trump was right that Iran wasn't going to react in the way that some people thought he was going to react. I think that just because that one time he was right and Iran was being very cautious, doesn't mean that they won't throw caution to the wind this time if the U.S. decides to attack. I think that this time they really have a lot more to lose than, yes, their most famous general, yes, their most accomplished general, they have, but which they lost, and they now know how accomplished he was and how good he was for Iran's benefit in terms of their own view of what he could accomplish. But in terms of what they, right now, an attack is existential for Iran. And I think they would throw everything they have. And I think that's been communicated. It was communicated by Qalibaf, the Speaker of Parliament, a couple of days ago. And I'm sure Donald Trump heard that. And throwing everything they have against American interest and Israel is potentially quite damaging, which is why we've also seen the Saudis.
Is that a credible threat?
Yes. Well, the fact that they were able to get through the Iron Dome with some of their missiles the last time and killed 37 Israeli citizens showed the Israelis that it's credible on some level. And they have thousands of these missiles now. And everyone in the region, according to what we're reading, has been very worried about this. The Turks have publicly urged the U.S. not to attack. Qatar, now we've heard that Qatar, the UAE, and Saudis have urged privately Donald Trump to not attack Iran because they're worried about the fallout. Because now everyone believes, you know, you have Iran is basically a cornered animal. And what's it going to do if it's attacked? The top leadership of Iran are not going anywhere. They're not going to seek refuge in Moscow. They're not going to go to, they can't go to Damascus, a place they could have gone if there was going to be a war and a regime change. They're going to stick it out. And sticking it out means they're going to throw everything they have against, in the case of an attack.
Maybe you've noticed the stairs, the groceries, everything that's not as easy as they used to be. And you're starting to wonder, what would it look like to get a little help? At Care.com, asking for support doesn't mean giving up independence. The right kind of help lets you stay in charge. Whether you know what kind of care you need or you're just starting to look, Care.com is here to help. You can find background-checked in-home caregivers who fit your budget or explore senior living communities at your own pace. Read reviews, request tours, compare options. And if it all feels overwhelming, our senior care advisors, all master's-level social workers, can help you create a plan. For a limited time, use the code LISTEN20 for 20% off your initial Care.com subscription. That's LISTEN20, all one word, good for 20% off. Start your senior care journey with confidence.
So last fall, we had on this podcast Scott Anderson to talk about his really gripping book, King of Kings, about the fall of the Shah in 1979. And I am struck at the parallels with what we're seeing today and what we saw then, as he recounted the demonstrations against the Shah started spreading throughout the country in 1978 to more and more cities, becoming more and more combustible, to the point where the Shah was truly on his last legs. But the difference between then and now seems to me, then there was a singular organized opposition represented by the Ayatollah Khomeini, then in Paris, flies back to Iran, and that, you know, signals the final days of the Shah. Here, it is not clear there is a single opposition leader who can bring the country together. The best we have is Reza Pahlavi, the son of the Shah, and it's totally unclear just how much support he has. I'd be really interested in hearing from both of you on the parallels and the differences, and in particular, whether Pahlavi is the de facto alternative at this point, or whether there's some other configuration that could replace the regime. Jason, why don't you start?
Look, I've been asked this question a lot in recent days, and Human knows that I'm a diplomatic person and don't want to disparage anybody, so I won't. But I think when a resume is son of a deposed dictator and there's not that much else on the resume, it begs the question, you know, what has he led and how would he presume to lead a country of Iran's size? And I understand that, you know, a lot of folks out there will tell you that, you know, the ability to lead and charisma and all these sorts of things are genetic and passed down by generations, and he's the son of a monarch. Remember that the monarchy that his father ruled over, or, you know, symbolized, was invented by his grandfather. And I think in the history of Iran, it's probably the shortest lived tenure of leadership besides the Islamic Republic, right? I think it's 54 years. If you think of the...
I was always puzzled. They used to call it like, you know, the 10,000-year-old
25
peacock old. Throne. Yeah. In fact, the grandfather who created the monarchy had no hereditary ties to Cyrus the Great, as I recall.
So, again, I'm not trying to disparage or you know, cast doubt on anybody, but I think it just demands a lot more inquiry, right? And I know that there is a support structure around him in diaspora, and you know, they've created some plans, you know, transition plans that they talk about. I also know that, you know, he has a lot of followers on social media that do not display democratic tendencies at all, and how they, you know, go about anybody who questions them. And they would say, well, no, those are regime agents that are posing as, I mean, what I would like to see happen here is the incredibly talented and powerful Iranian diaspora, which wields massive amounts of capital and influence in this country, just not politically, figure out how to come together and constructively plan for a future of Iran that would be a connected society to the rest of the world. That's only going to happen if Iranians living abroad play a role in that. And so far, we haven't even been able to kind of decide on, you know, what the right flag is for a future free Iran. And that seems to me to indicate that, one, we might be missing the moment, or two, that we're not built for it.
I agree. I mean, Jason, you are being very diplomatic about the Shah or the pretender Shah, and because some of his closest advisors have threatened people like Jason and myself, both Jason and myself, and have called us regime stooges. And in some cases threatened us with violence. And these are not just people, random people on social media. These are some of his close advisors, people that he associates with. And other people have said, look, if you want to be a leader, you have to disassociate yourself from these people who are tearing people apart on the internet, on social media and all that. And Jason's right. I mean, I wrote about this a couple of days ago for The Intercept about Pahlavi. And his chances. I really don't see any kind of evidence that he has created any kind of network inside Iran. Yes, his name is very well known. Yes, he can say, come out, please, and march on Thursday night, and people did. But when he said, come out or go out on strike to the workers in Iran, they didn't. When he said in June of last year, after the 12-day war, he said, I'm going to recruit people to defect from the security forces, the IRGC, the Basij, the security forces in Iran, and then subsequently claimed that he had 50,000 defectors ready to go at the right time. Well, the right time was a week ago, and yep, not a single one defected. So the evidence is not there for him to have any kind of real organization. Remember, as you pointed out, Michael, Khomeini had every single local mosque in the entire country as his base. Every single one. He was sitting in Paris, first in Najaf and then in Paris, but he could disseminate his views or the revolution through every single mosque in Iran. And there's plenty of mosques. Imagine being able to get to every church in America and every synagogue in America. That was the power that Khomeini had that you mentioned. And that doesn't exist right now. And the only other regime opponent is Mariam Rajabi, president-elect of the National, I can't even remember the whatever it's called, but it's the MEK, who are despised in Iran. And the reason you never hear her name, you never hear the MEK chant in any of these protests, 10,000, 100,000 people protest, is because they are reviled for having taken Saddam Hussein's side in the Iran-Iraq war. They're in exile in Albania right now. They do have foot soldiers in Iran who have committed terrorist acts, have taken out various scientists, assassinated people, but it's a small group of people. The other thing that Jason mentioned, which is a very valid point, is about all the ethnic minorities. And there is a concern among Iranians inside Iran with some of these ethnic minorities who are armed, such as the Lors from Lorestan and the Kurds especially, who have armed separatist movements, that someone weak like Reza Pahlavi could unleash those forces and would not be able to control the cohesiveness of the Iranian nation.
This is, I think, that cohesiveness, before we move on from that, I mean, this for most of us is the biggest concern, right? Like the territorial integrity of Iran,
absolutely
has to stay intact. And when you look at it, there are a handful of ethnic groups bordering countries with large populations of those same ethnic groups. In my experience of being, of Iranian origin and meeting people of Iranian origin and in Iran, their Iranianness has always trumped their Kurdishness or Jewishness or Muslimness. This is something to protect, you know, not just for Iran, but I think for the world, right? And I think probably Bibi Netanyahu sees a partitioned Iran as advantageous to him. I don't think that that's true. I think a stable, intact Iran with a free economy and open society would be in the world and the region's interest.
And I want to follow up on just something he said before, which I don't want to lose, which is you talked about the diaspora and the potential of the diaspora to sort of communicate, get together, help rebuild whatever is coming next in Iran.
Yeah.
Any signs that that's happening?
No, unfortunately. And, if you look at some of the, biggest tech companies in the world, at or near the top, there are Iranians in all of them, right? The fact that we can't even get these people back online means that, very powerful and connected people in this country who are Iranian are not using their influence effectively, right? CEO of Uber, has born in Iran and, has talked sometimes about his, desire to help. I think he's probably in a pretty good position to, pick up the phone and talk to people in Washington, whether they're in Congress or in the White House or the NSC. So that we've got something called direct to cellular internet service that exists now. Anybody who has a smartphone that was made after 2020 can access this, but it requires flipping a switch. And to flip that switch, Congress would have to legislate doing that for Iran, or the White House would have to do an executive order. I'm not sure that anybody in Congress or the White House knows about this, right? So the messaging, the organization, we're somewhere between 1 million and 2 million people living in this country. We're the highest educated, highest income earning non-European immigrant population. We should have some political influence. We don't. That's our fault.
That's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct. And the one organization that was started by someone to be that kind of umbrella organization has become something that many Iranians in the diaspora consider to be pro-regime. and that's NIAC. And whether they are or not is
tell us who they are.
National Iranian American Council. And they have two branches. One is to be a lobbying group, which and they're registered as lobbyists in Congress. And the other is to just be a council for Iranian Americans to kind of come together.
And they're supportive of the regime?
Well, people accuse them of being supportive of the regime because they've been anti-war, anti-sanctions, anti-attacks on Iran.
Pro-engagement.
Yeah.
Who heads it?
Jamal Abdi. Yeah, his name. It's based in Washington. Before it was Trita Parsi, who a lot of people again consider to be a regime stooge. So what's happened in the Iranian diaspora, and I think Jason was absolutely right about this, is a lot of the people who are very powerful, and I'm by the way, in tech and banking, there's a lot of very, very powerful bankers. There's people in the oil business, very, very wealthy billionaires, Iranians. And many of them have looked at our diaspora politically and said, I don't want no part of that. That's not something I want to be involved with. Because if you look at the vitriol that's spread, that's passed out between pro-monarchy, anti-Islam, pro-Islam, pro-regime, anti-regime in social media or even in essays or op-eds, they don't want to be involved. You know, people have careers, they have businesses, they have things going on, their kids are American. It's like, okay, there's no unity to be seen. And so the ones who are the most powerful Iranians, the most visible, the most high profile Iranians, generally, unless they're political or unless like Jason, a writer, myself, a writer, are just like, you know, leave me out of this. You know, he mentioned Dara Khosrowshahi, who's the CEO of Uber, who lived in Iran, I think, until he was 11 and grew up in New York, in Westchester County, New York. You know, he has occasionally said things, and apparently he met with the Iranian president this last time. The Iranian president was here. Pezeshkian was here in September for the UN. But realistically, there's, you know, he said his biggest contribution has been if the regime changes, we'll be the first to invest in Iran. Of course, he'll have to go up against Snap, which is their version of Uber inside Iran.
By the way, Uman, you mentioned the MEK before. They were, of course, for years considered a terrorist group by the United States. Eventually they got that lifted. Yeah. But I was scrolling through X the other day, and I came across a post from, of all people, Rudy Giuliani attacking Reza Pahlavi, saying he's got no support, he has no claim of legitimacy to lead the Iranian people. And I thought, that's seemingly odd. And then I remembered why he has been long time on the payroll of the MEK.
Yeah. Along with John Bolton and others.
Yeah, and others. I think Louis Free, the former FBI director, was on it. I mean, they managed to recruit quite a few folks to their cause. Jason, can you remind us why it is you were imprisoned by the regime in 2016 and why they kept you locked up for a year and a half before they let you go?
You know, and I'm glad to be on with Human, because, you know, he's one of the individuals who had, you know, the most close up view to all of that. But, you know, my own interpretation is that I was taken by the Revolutionary Guard to disrupt the nuclear negotiations. And
you were reporting for the Washington Post at the time.
I've been living and working in Iran for 5 years, reporting for the Washington Post. With full accreditation for 2 years. Coincidentally, or you know, worth mentioning that literally the morning of the day that I was arrested, I was given a 1 year extension of my press credentials. As Human well knows, you know, there are competing security services inside Iran. The ones that oversee press credentials are linked to the Ministry of Intelligence, which is a professional intelligence service, comparatively. But my wife and I were abducted at gunpoint in our home by the Revolutionary Guard Corps intelligence service, which, you know, are terrorists. I mean, you know, the Revolutionary Guard Corps writ large has been designated as a terror organization by the United States. I have argued against that kind of blanket designation, all blanket designations, but the Quds Force and the intelligence service, you know, there's a very strong case to be made that these are terrorists. Anyway, they took me hostage, held me for a year and a half, and I think it did disrupt the negotiations. It certainly became a spanner in trying to get the deal done. And then it was part of the implementation of the JCPOA in 2016 was the release of myself and several other Americans and several Iranian Americans being held in U.S. prisons on sanctions violations. So I tell people that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the JCPOA was a wash. You know, it got me taken hostage and it got me out.
Michael, the thing, and Jason, you know, and as he mentioned, I was covering the JCPOA talks with Ann Curry, with NBC News, and so we were virtually every single round of negotiations, and we're doing documentaries and all that. And so, because of that, and access to the Iranian team who were on the reform side, I would, as Jason and his brother and his mother know, would press the Iranian team, especially the foreign minister, to, you know, what is going on. Jason's brother would come to some of these rounds of negotiations, especially in Vienna with the very long, drawn out negotiations. And I'd see him and we'd go and talk, and the foreign minister was like, yes, I'm doing everything I can. But, you know, clearly the foreign minister did not have the power to get Jason released. And as we have seen since then, and I know Jason knows this as well, the competing power centers do not like the former foreign ministers.
Not at all.
To the point where today there was a rumor that some of them put out, MPs in parliament, that he had been arrested. He and Rouhani had been arrested. Now, I doubt that that's true. I haven't been able to confirm that, but he is particularly despised for having done the JCPOA, for having defended people like Siam Aknamazi, another longtime prisoner, Iranian-American prisoner, defending Jason Rezaian, saying, you know, this is ridiculous. This is, and, you know, you could even argue in his case that even if you thought Jason deserves to be in prison, even if you just thought Siam Ak deserves to be in prison, it's harming Iran's image. So on that very cynical view, you should be releasing them. But he tried everything, I know, and unfortunately was unsuccessful. And fortunately, Jason did get out.
Not that I want to draw any comparisons, but given we were just talking about Jason's arrest by the Iranian regime, this week, another Washington Post journalist had her home raided by the FBI, who seized her devices as part of a leak investigation. So just want to put that out there in terms of when we're talking about freedom of the press. But I'd like to wrap up here with two questions for both of you. Number one, is there a role for the United States to play here, either overtly or covertly? And number two, this is January 2026. By the end of the year, will the regime still be in power? Uman, you go first.
Well, I don't know about a role. I don't know what role it can play short of just, I mean, you know, the internet is probably the place it can be the most effective in helping if it wants to. If the Trump administration really does want to help the people in Iran to communicate and be able to organize, that would be literally the only way America could be effective without actually hurting the cause of people who are hoping for change, whether they're hoping for change internally or whether they're hoping for a complete regime change. And I think we don't know how many want a complete regime change and how many people want a serious change inside Iran that allows things to dig. So that's the first thing. Secondly, what was the second part? I'm sorry, I forgot.
A year from now. Or by the end of the year.
By the end of the year.
Will the regime still be in power?
That's an impossible thing to gauge. I think if short of war, unless there's a war, unless there is a decapitation of the regime, I think the answer is probably yes, but I also that it will be around unless, you know, I don't see a regime collapse at this point. I don't see a defection or cracks in the security services. We haven't seen it yet. I don't think it will be there unless there's external forces. I think that my answer would have to be yes, the regime will be there and will be cracking down on future protests that probably will erupt.
Jason, same two questions.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take the second one first. I don't think that it's wise to, you know, make predictions about these sorts of things. If they are still in power, I think they'll be even weaker than they are today, but also probably even more brutally repressive, right? And we see, you know, how that goes, you know, in places like Syria and others. So, you know, I'm just hopeful that bloodshed can be limited and that people's dreams and aspirations are, that the country starts moving in that direction rather than away from it. Second, how the U.S. could help. I think the internet is clearly the piece of the puzzle where we could be doing something right now. We could have been doing something for years. We claim to have been doing things for years, and we haven't been doing it, right? So that's one place to help.
When you say the internet, what do you mean? Using it how?
Ensuring that Iranians are able to continue to access it.
Okay.
Right? For the ability.
You're not talking about cyber attacks shutting down the electric grid or something along those lines.
Just,
okay.
You know,
just wanted to clarify. Okay.
Keeping people online. The other thing that I would say is, you know, I'm no you know, historian, but if I remember correctly, you know, before the fall of the Soviet Union, there was a lot of dialogue with not only dissidents inside the Soviet Union, but leadership of the Soviet Union. It was a foregone conclusion that that system was not long for the world. And you have to find the people within these systems who understand that their current situation is no longer tenable, and that, you know, stability is preferable to chaos, right? Gorbachev was not a Jeffersonian Democrat, right? But he understood that the Soviet Union wasn't going to last. And there are those people inside the Iranian system right now. And I think we need to be communicating with them and understanding better. I'm not saying make deals with them or prolong their power, but understand better what's happening there. Because I do think that, to Human's point, you know, there haven't been defections yet, and there might not be. But not having clarity about what's going on inside this country is no longer a valid excuse. Right?
I agree. And I would finally say I would not be surprised if there are members of the Trump administration foreign policy team who are communicating with some of the people inside Iran who might be like that. We know that Steve Witkoff has, you know, sure, the Iranian foreign ministers, they text each other. They've admitted it. On both sides. But I also think that as a last point, that the people, it's exactly what Jason says, those people inside Iran who are pragmatic and do want to see some change and do want to help the people and are perhaps, if you want, for want of a better word, the reformist, they know that even though the crackdown has been successful or can be successful for the near future, that long term it's not tenable. And those people, I think, need to be encouraged to help, because there's no other option right now.
Well, clearly the Trump administration is communicating with somebody, because
Trump said, we've been told.
Right. Yes, right. Exactly.
That the executions were stopped. So somebody from inside is telling him something. But look, I want to thank both of you for a really illuminating discussion about a very murky subject right now. And this has been enormously helpful for us and hopefully our listeners. And we'll want to stay in touch with both of you as events proceed. So thanks a lot for joining us.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Our democracy is hanging by a thread, but we know it's not about just winning and losing each battle. It's about persistence and building resilience.
That's why we're launching the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
If you're looking for ways to get engaged or just for ways to stay sane, we want to help you navigate what comes next.
It's an exciting collaboration with political dynamo Jess Craven, author of the Chop Wood, Carry Water newsletter.
And grassroots activist Steve Pearson, host of the How We Win podcast.
Every week on the Practivist Pod, we're going to have important conversations with changemakers, give you practical ways to make an impact, have some fun, and inspire hope.
This is more than a podcast. It's a place for our community to grow our practice of advocacy for justice, equity, and progress.
Action is the best antidote for anxiety. So subscribe to the Practivist Pod today.
Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.